The controller of the company was basically using the company checking account as a personal slush fund. And then once he got the signed check back, he would erase the payee and put in who he was needing to pay.
You're listening to Chrissy Powers, a certified public accountant, certified fraud examiner, and the owner of Power Forensic Accounting. Welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
CFC is probably the most valuable forensic credential out there, in my opinion.
In this episode, we discuss how she got started in forensic accounting, why she started her own forensic accounting firm, the value of a CPA license and CFE credential, and the importance of books and conferences in growing her firm. She is a certified public accountant and a certified fraud examiner. She is currently the owner of Powers Forensic Accounting. Chrissy Powers, welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
How did you choose forensic accounting as a profession?
Well, I guess the stars just aligned perfectly. When I was a senior in college, I had an ethics class, and one of our assignments was we had to bring in some current events that were going on. And at the time, there was a case in Franklin County here in Ohio with Jesse Odie at the clerk of court's office, and he had misappropriated funds. So that was the case that I started following and bringing in the updates, if you will, to my ethics class. And then I was lucky enough that when I landed my first job out of college as an auditor at a local CPA firm here in Columbus, Ohio, that my first engagement that May was to go out and work a fraud investigation. And just like we all read, you know, it was send the newbie out to go through and determine, you know, what cash is missing or what has gone wrong in a cash account. So I got my taste and my feet wet there. And then after that, I just was hooked that I knew that I really enjoyed doing fraud investigations. And that was the area that I wanted to move my career towards in practice in.
When you started your first case with your new job, what was the scheme?
The controller of the company was basically using the company checking account as a personal slush fund, paying a lot of personal expenses out of that checking account. And he went on vacation. And while he was out of the office on vacation, the receptionist thought she would be helpful and would do the bank reconciliation. So that was one less thing that he had to do when he returned to the office. When she opened up the bank statement and was going through and looking at the canceled checks, so right there, I'm dating myself, she saw checks that were written to GMAC, and the entire company was Ford loyal, and all of their vehicles, all their fleet vehicles were Ford. So she knew there was a problem, but it was a construction company, and the office of the staff that were in the office on a regular basis was small. And she had the dilemma of, what do I do? And thankfully, she took it to the owner, who was a CPA, and brought it to his attention that these checks were being written, and she didn't believe them to be company expenses. The firm that I had just been hired at took on that engagement and sent me out there to go through and determine what the total dollar amount of the misappropriations were and see if there were any other schemes that were going on there. It was unfortunate for the company because at that time the red flags were there. The suspect was living beyond his means, taking lots of vacations were a red flag, and lots of trips to Vegas, gambling. Had even bought his fiance's engagement ring and paid for portions of that through his employer. Once I got on site that time and started looking at historical bank statements and pulling out canceled checks, the previous canceled checks had been destroyed. So when he was getting those bank statements, he was getting rid of them. And we later came to discover that they did have segregation of duties in place where he would cut the checks and the owner would sign them, but he was using erasable pen. because they weren't processing everything back at the during that particular time on a printer. So he would write it out to a legitimate vendor of the company. And then once he got the signed check back, he would erase the payee and put in who he was needing to pay that happened to be his personal expenses.
That is actually pretty interesting. Wow. And there's all the indicators of fraud right there. And no one saw it until a secretary just happened to try to be helpful and uncovered it all. That's cool. That's actually a pretty cool first case.
Yep, I got my feet wet. And then I decided at that time, like, this is something that I would like to do because every case is different. But just having started into public accounting, the first road to move up the ladder, if you will, is you have to get your CPA credential when you're in public accounting. So that was what I had to focus on first before I was able to go and obtain any other credentials. Plus, most of those, you have to have a certain number of years of experience in those areas to become certified in.
What compelled you to leave, and then later on in your career, you started your own firm? Why did you start your own firm?
Well, initially, at one point in my career, I was with a firm that did traditional tax and attestation services, as well as the forensic accounting. So when I was with that firm, I was able to take the CFE exam and started to do a lot more forensic accounting on a regular basis. And that firm merged with a regional firm, and I was able to get rid of my traditional clients and shift them to one of our other offices so that I could focus 100% on forensic accounting. And as the years moved on and we got a new president of the organization, they decided that they wanted to shut down our forensic accounting department because our workflow, if you will, was not able to be written down on a paper 8 to 10 weeks out. We could show you all the cases that we had, but what I'd be working on 3 weeks from now, I couldn't guarantee because of continuances and such. So they decided that with the new management and president that forensic accounting and litigation support was not for them, and they shut our entire division down. I had clients at the time that had already named me as expert on their matter, and it was too late to name a new expert. So I was like, well, I could try to take these clients and go to a different regional firm, or maybe I ought to start my own practice. So I talked to one of the other women that was in our department, and we went out on our own. At that particular time, we were together for almost 10 years, and then the two of us separated and we started our own independent practices, which is hence Powers Forensic Accounting that I'm operating under today.
What kind of services do you provide in your firm right now?
We do a lot of fraud investigations. We do bankruptcy services, so that's where you get into the fraudulent conveyances and preferential payment. We do forensic and investigative accounting, you know, so that's your fraud detection and deterrence. A lot of marital dissolution and divorces, also involved with collaborative divorce, which is non-litigated divorce, damages and lost profits calculation, estate and probate work, that there's a lot of fraud in that arena where people are worried that the trustee or another family member has misappropriated the assets of the estate or probate. So I get involved with going through and following the money, if you will, with that. And receiverships, the court steps in and starts to either wind down a business or continue its operations, and they may suspect that money has been diverted or assets. So they'll call someone like myself in to go through the records and determine if everything is accounted for.
What training or certifications do you think are necessary to do what you're doing now?
Well, I've got my CPA and my CFE, which is Certified Fraud Examiner. I also am a CFF, which is credentialed through the AICPA, and that stands for Certified in Financial Forensics. I'm also under NACFA certified as a CVA, which is a Certified Valuation Analyst, although currently, I'm not doing any valuation work. So all of those credentials help to show my knowledge and level of expertise and assist with getting qualified, if you will, as an expert before the court.
To do what you do, Is a CPA necessary, or it just helps bring your credentials to the table when you go to court?
I would tell you that it's necessary, and most attorneys are looking for that when they're looking to hire an expert, because I have to assume that all of my cases are going to end up in a litigated setting, or at least we work them that way so that we have proper protocols in place for record retention and chain of custody and such. But there are experts that I come across that don't have the CPA credential. They may have a degree in math or experience in doing these types of calculations, done a lot of economics, and the court will still qualify them as an expert. But in my mind, very valuable credential, and it's something that I would tell any younger person or anyone looking to get into the forensic accounting that you really should go after and obtain that.
What about CFE? You have the same thoughts as CFE?
Yes, CFE is probably the most valuable forensic credential out there, in my opinion, for the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, but that is not just to accountants. There are bankers, there are attorneys, there's law enforcement that hold the CFE credential, whereas like the CFF credential is administered through the American Institute of CPAs, and that's only given to accountants. The CFE has been around much longer and is a very well-established credential. So to me, that's the most valuable forensic one out there. There's some others that are out there from various other organizations and such. But to me, the CFE is the best one.
So if someone's going to prioritize their certifications, so they get the CPA first or CFE?
Yeah, that would be the order I would tell you to get it in. Now, when you go to sit for your CFE, you have to score so many points in order to get that credential. And one thing is you have to have 2 years of experience. So, you know, you may have worked in public accounting as an auditor for 2 years, you know, where you're looking at internal controls and such. So that would count as your years of experience. And with the CFE, they're also looking at the test is over 4 different areas, so you're learning a little bit about the law, the chain of custody, how crooks think, so there's a little bit of psychology. The accounting piece, typically, of the 4 sections is the hardest for most individuals. So I know I've had detectives in that and law enforcement that'll call and say, can you just walk me through different sections and explain the different reports that you should be asking for from an accounting perspective? Because without that depth, that's a difficult area for them.
In your firm currently, what is your typical client, or who is your typical client?
It all depends. I work for individuals. I work for corporations. So anyone potentially could be a client. I don't have a size or a net worth for what those clients are. So I get involved with individuals that are getting divorced, but I also might get involved because an individual calls and says, my grandma's estate is being managed by my brother, and I know that she owned X, Y, and Z, and I don't believe that everything has made it into the estate, you know. So, and sometimes I get hired directly by the law firm. Other times, clients themselves hire me, whether they're individuals, corporations, partnerships, nonprofits.
How are you getting your clients? Are you advertising? Do you give seminars, speaking, write books? How do they know to come to you?
I do advertise in some of the expert directories. I have ads in my local bar association. I do speaking engagements, write articles, network with lawyers, bankers, CPAs, even business owners. I'm active on LinkedIn, just wherever I can get in front of that right group of people that would be a potential client or referral source. And now you have a podcast. I think you're my second podcast that I've done. So podcast as well.
Well, it is up and coming podcast. That's very true. It's definitely an information resource for those who are actually looking for answers. As a matter of fact, as a side note, I believe Google is considered the number one. And if I'm not mistaken, YouTube is number two. And Amazon's like number three. So when it comes to getting answers, people are going to Google, YouTube, and Amazon. That's the first steps they're going to, believe it or not. Well, Google now has podcasts, and YouTube is YouTube, but people are putting their podcasts on YouTube now. And as well as Amazon also has a directory for podcasts as well. So it's interesting. They're now the go-to search engines for people trying to find answers.
Okay. And I also have a website that's very thorough, which is www.powersforensic.com. What I've tried to do there through the help of my expert witness consultant is I have a section of case descriptions that sanitizes, if you will, various cases that I've worked over the years, just to give everyone kind of an example of, oh yeah, she's done something similar to this before, you know, different things like that that help to show my knowledge and depth of experience.
In your experience as a forensic accountant and doing fraud examinations, what do you see in the future in this industry? Where is it going?
Well, I see certain aspects of it becoming more automated, and AI is a hot topic that you see, especially with the AICPA when they put out their magazines and that. But to a certain extent, you cannot automate everything in forensic accounting. You can use the data mining software, pull out things that appear to be red flags, if you will, but you still have to have a live body to look at that and go and find the particular detail, like have someone pull the invoices or look at an employee's file, such things like that are going to be really hard to automate. Also looking at testifying, or, you know, once the numbers are analyzed, somebody needs to put an opinion on that, get up on the stand and testify before the court, should it make it that far. I see more automation coming. We've gone a lot to over the years since I started. When I first started, canceled checks were returned. Now those are all digitized. Moving towards trying to get all my records in digital format when it makes the most sense and when it's not a burden on the client. I will take the bank statements now, and I have a consultant that does it for me, but I've looked into purchasing the software myself, which will take the bank statements and convert it all into Excel, and then, you know, set up pivot tables after they've been classified. You know, so just using technology to make our lives easier so we can get through the voluminous amount of records, because let's face it, as forensic accountants, there's tons of records to look at so that we can get the job done more effective and more efficiently.
What software are you using now? I'm assuming, do you use Microsoft Word, Microsoft Excel at the very basic level?
Yeah, I have Word and Excel. I use PowerPoint to do my presentation. I've become a pro at Zoom and use BlueJeans and all the other platforms over the last year, like many of us have done because of the pandemic. I've actually given testimony now over the Zoom platform for one of the courts. They decided to use that to try to keep moving forward with their docket versus some of the others that have just moved forward with putting continuances in place and pushing stuff further out.
I guess what I'm drilling down to regarding the forensic accounting, putting things together, analyzing it, putting things together, what are you using other than Microsoft Word and Excel? Is there a special program out there? Are you putting everything in PDF at the end of the day? I'm just kind of curious how you're working the forensic accounting to ultimately get to write a report, and you have to analyze something. What do you do? What tools are you using to do that?
Depending on the size of the client and how sophisticated they are with their IT department, I could be just using Excel. I could be getting their accounting software and getting reports either electronically or PDFs to review. If they're a larger client and they've got the IT department, I will get a dump, if you will, of what I need out of their accounting software, and we'll pull it into ACL. Other firms may be using like IDEA. Those are the top two that I see out there, but doing the analysis, and then I write my reports in Word and convert that to a PDF. Lock it because you don't want an attorney or a client to alter what your opinion is. And that typically is how I'm producing my reports and exhibits.
Right. If people don't know this, that you can use Microsoft Word, if you added something or take things out or maybe reuse the same form, and for one client and reads it again, there's metadata in the background and they can actually find out what you changed. which is kind of scary when you think about it.
But typically you don't send out, you would never want to send out a Word version to anybody because they could alter it.
Correct.
Your quote draft of anything, even if that is in PDF, is under federal rules not supposed to be discoverable, not to say that an attorney on the other side might not try.
What advice would you give to someone who wants to be a fraud examiner, who's interested in forensic accounting, or who's starting out their own? What advice would you give to them?
One thing would be to do a lot of reading. Firms that I've been with that were heavily focused in forensic accounting, we had a really good library, if you will, of different books that are out there. So it's good to read and keep up on your skills. Reading your fraud magazine that ACFE sends out, finding a good mentor. I would tell you that I would say helped me early on in my career. Someone that can point you in the right direction. And if you're a member of ACFE, even a student member, they have a mentor program. Various other organizations like the AICPA also have mentor programs in that. But if you're with a firm or even involved with any of the local ACFE chapters, they can hook you up with a mentor within that firm to help guide you and ask questions in that. That can be invaluable.
It's interesting you say that. On the previous podcast episode, mentorship was actually one of the items that he said that he definitely used. I call it the miracle grow of learning is getting a mentor because they can tell you what to do, what not to do. He gave his success a lot of credit to the mentors that he had early on in his career. They helped him out versus just flailing around trying to figure it all out. But yeah, I would agree mentorship is very, very important. What about, you talk about books. What kind of books are you talking about for forensic accountants?
There's books that Joseph Wells has written, like The Frankensteins of Fraud, that are just a collection of short case studies and engagements that him and other certified fraud examiners have written. There's expert witness marketing books that I've read over the years to help me with, you know, how do I market my practice, even when I was with the other firm, like what's the best way to market? Because as an expert witness where you could end up on the stand, the opposing attorney's job is to discredit you and make you emotional or upset you. So they'll try to use various advertisements. We have to watch how we advertise as potentially ending up in court as an expert witness. So the expert witness marketing book by Rosalie Hamilton, she does nothing but help anybody in various disciplines that are expert witnesses market themselves and their practices. The SEEK group out there has How to Market Your Expert Witness Practice, their evidence. Based Best Practices by James Manna Graffiti and Stephen and Alex Babsky. That's a father and son. So just a lot of reading. ACFE offers a lot of different books that I've collected over the years. NACFA offers books on damage calculations, some fraud valuation. Noting when I started all of this, you know, I have a lot of those in paper, hardback paper books versus now you're able to buy so many of them digitally or download them to your Nook or whatnot. The AICPA, I'm a member of their forensics and valuations practice group. When I renew my dues annually, they refer to that in acronym terms as the FVS section. But with that, you have access to their forensics library that's all in the cloud now. And they have practice aids out there that help you work your cases or give you pointers on how to do things in that. And back in the day, those used to be mailed out to us in paper. Now they're all digital. So, you know, if I have a question or I want to cite a source, if you will, when I'm writing a report as to how we do things or what our best practices state to do something, I'll pull those out. They just help you along the way. There's interesting books and articles and in that that give you those aha moments.
I'll be sure to put a lot of those books on the show notes so the audience can get a link to them and know exactly what we're talking about. Tell me about a fraud investigation that you're most proud of or something that made a difference in your career.
Oh, there's so many of them and each of them has something unique to it. I guess one of the ones that comes to mind when you ask me that is I worked an investigation where the owner called us in and said, we have this girl who makes all of our deposits and she does the bookkeeping and, you know, she's stealing from us. And I'm like, okay, you know, so we went in, we had a private investigator that worked with us that put a pin camera in the office where she was at, you know, and we had to be careful as to how that pin camera was installed since it was a woman. So there wouldn't be anything inappropriate that it could catch. Different things like that. And they use QuickBooks, which was their accounting software, which is double-sided journal entry accounting package, but it's a fraudster's best friend because you're able to record adjustments and invoices and various different accounting related transactions and go back and edit them after the fact. So what was ultimately going on is when the front desk would receive payments in cash, they would give an invoice and receipt to the customer. She would go to make that deposit and would take some of the cash and put it in her purse and keep it for personal use, not deposit it into the company bank account, and then go into QuickBooks and delete the invoice to the customer. So once we discovered how the scheme was ultimately occurring, we went through the filing cabinet that was on site that had all of the invoices in it. So typically you would expect to see, we start with invoice number, let's say 1,000, and it should move sequentially through up until the next invoice number that should be issued. From the QuickBooks electronic version, we could see gaps in invoice number sequence. So we knew what was missing. We could also see the audit trail in QuickBooks that showed who made those deletions that were logged in with that username. However, when you have your sticky note on your computer with your username and password, you can't 100% prove that it was that individual that made those keystrokes because a lot of other employees have access to that username and password since it's in a common area. But the suspect wasn't smart enough to remove the paper invoices that were in the filing cabinet. So we were able to...
They left the evidence a couple feet away. I got it. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So we were able to take the paper invoices and recreate from the invoice gaps in their QuickBooks, which invoice numbers were missing, go pull the paper ones, determine the dollar amount, and have evidence for that.
I'm assuming you have to go back to the client or the customer and say, did you pay this? And they'll say, yeah, we paid in cash. And there's some type of verification behind all that.
It was how the system worked within that organization was when the guys at the front desk sold the item, they would apparently print two copies. One would go to the customer and one would be maintained internally, and they would write paid in cash on it. So all of the invoices that were missing from QuickBooks, when we found the paper copies in the drawer that matched up with the gap in invoice sequence, had handwritten on it, paid in cash.
Oh, that's what we call a clue. A coincidence, right?
Yes.
So, sheer coincidence.
You know, it was a nice little trail, if you will, for us as an investigator that the stars were aligning. We also had on the pin camera that was installed, we also had her count down the money for various different days and had her putting it directly into her purse and not including it with the batch of checks and other items that were being deposited with the bank statement. So we had that on camera too. The ironic piece of this was that when the interrogation was done, which I wasn't on the interrogation team, but when the interrogation was done, she did confess to it, but she also flipped and came out with information that the owner himself was committing fraud when he filed his tax return because he wasn't reporting all of the income that he was taking in, even if it made it to the bank account. So it sort of was a double-edged sword as to how they wanted to proceed forward from there, whether or not to prosecute. She did make a written confession and made restitution. Family members gave her money to pay it back. But the owner did not prosecute her because he was worried about her proceeding forward with notifying the Internal Revenue Service that he was underreporting income of the business to them beyond what she was getting off the top or siphoning.
Unbelievable. That is a great story, though. That is a very great, that's got a lot of elements to it. That's a great story. Are there any resources or training that have helped you that you've haven't already discussed in your journey as a forensic accountant? Anything else out there that's helped you? We talked about books, we talked about education, we talked about mentorship. What else is out there that you could probably think of?
Conferences are a good one. I have gained a lot of wealth and knowledge, if you will, by attending the annual Association of Certified Fraud Examiners conference that's held once a year. I make a lot of contacts there that I've used, as well as at my local fraud conference that we put on up here in Columbus, Ohio. If I need some assistance with verifying numbers on the back of a canceled check, I've got contacts at various different banks. Over the years, you know, you meet different individuals that work at different organizations that you may need to call on to say, I've got this document. Can you help explain coding or anything along those lines on there? But the education at those conferences are great. They rank the training as easy for individuals that are new coming in, and others, they rank as higher level. So you know which breakout sessions, various different tracks. They offer most of the time at least 10 different breakout tracks, or if not more. So you can go and you can jump between them, taking an investigative track, dealing with interrogations, and then jumping and taking a couple on accounting, and then taking another on emerging trends and different things like that. I've also gotten value from the SEEK group, which does training for expert witnesses. So when you go to something like that, you've got people from different disciplines. Forensic accountants may be there. You would have handwriting analysts there. You could have doctors that are going to testify as medical experts. But with those, they're working on making you better at depositions, other training on testimony, expert reports. And those are majority led by attorneys. So they're going to say and try to critique and make you better with your testifying skills and your report writing as to how opposing counsel would rip either you or your report apart, and just trying to polish those skills. AICTA also does a forensics conference. So I try to shake it up and do one of those a year. Don't keep coming back to the same one year after year, because at some point I try to bounce back and forth. Reed Technique was great. I did the Reed Technique early in my career on interrogating suspects and learning the proper way to do that.
I bet your kids and husband hate that.
I have two teenage boys, and you know, they're not getting away with much.
It's never good. Mom comes back home from an interrogation training class. It's never good. No, it's never good. What do you wish you had known before you started?
If I would have known that I was going to end up in forensic accounting, I would have probably done a double major in my college career on either criminology or psychology, because that plays such a vital role in what I do. Trying to think like a crook and have an empathy, or trying to relate to whether it's a suspect in a fraud investigation or even an individual who's getting divorced, and, you know, having the empathy and helping them to understand that you're there and to get to the truth in that. So those are a couple things that if I would have known when I was in college that this was the direction that my career was going to go, that I would have probably picked one of those two and done a double major, or at least taken more classes in those two areas, because that definitely would have added benefit.
So including, I'm assuming that you got an accounting degree. Was that what you got?
Yeah, I have a business degree with emphasis in accounting.
Okay. And then the soft skills regarding how people think, react, those type things would be definitely a major plus when it comes to dealing with forensic accounting and dealing with people that are, frankly, have been defrauded, or the ones who are actually doing the fraud actions.
Yeah. Yes.
Very good. All right. You ready for the final four questions?
Sure.
All right. Final four. What is your biggest motivation now?
I would say my biggest motivation is that I enjoy helping and teaching people. So in order for me to be able to help and teach more people, I need to grow my book of business so that I can expand my firm so that we can help more people.
What book or books have changed your life or thinking?
I guess as it relates to my thinking related to business, it would be those expert witness marketing books that kind of just hones in on the specialty niche of what I do and my firm does. Because what's different for us than most CPAs in public accounting is that most of my clients are non-returning clients. Hopefully this organization is only going to have fraud occur once, or you're only getting divorced once. So unlike landing a tax engagement that if you do a good job, they're going to come back year after year for the tax prep, most of my clients hopefully aren't going to have the need for forensic accounting services, or at least the majority of the forensic accounting services I offer again. Now, if I'm working for a law firm, I do get repeat business. However, they can't send all of their work to you because it would look like your firm and you are in their pocket and they're just buying your opinion. So they do have to mix it up, even if they are very confident and enjoy working with you and like your work product. So that's what kind of makes the forensic accounting niche a little different. And I really feel, you know, we market our services different than your traditional CPA or accountant.
Right. Is there any book or books that have changed your life when it comes to personally that you could discuss?
Do you ever read Who Moved My Cheese?
I have. Yes. It's all about change.
It is. And I actually pulled that off the shelf for my husband a couple of years back because he had some management change going on within his organization. But that can just relate on so many levels to so many different things, personally and professionally, even like with the pandemic and that going on right now. It's definitely will be used over and over again throughout my life that I can go back and relate to it and adapting with change.
I guess when you get older, it's a little more difficult sometimes, but one of the most frustrating things to deal with when it comes to coworkers or people that you work with is they don't want to change. And it's not change personally. There's just a new way of doing things. Hey, instead of doing an adding machine tape, we don't have to do that anymore. We can now use Excel, but I like my adding machine tape. Well, you know, that's just not where it goes these days. It's going to have to be Excel. But I like my adding machine tape. I got it, but you're going to have to go with Excel. And it's this mental shift that there's change involved. Yeah, but it's going to be for the better. And it can be frustrating for those people who survive on chaos and like change. And there's other people out there like, I like the way I think my adding machine tape. Well, those who don't know an adding machine tape, you have to make Google it. But yeah, it's I haven't used my adding machine probably 15 years, but still.
I threw my 10 key away. We don't need that anymore.
Yeah, the 10 key is now on the keyboard. Yep. All right, share something that you have purchased in the last 12 months, less than $100, that you enjoyed or make your job easier. If it's good enough for Chrissy Powers, it's good enough for the world. What is that thing?
Oh, and I have to give my husband credit for this because he's the one that pushed me to make this change. A monitor mount stand that's height adjustable and has a gas spring, so it clips on the end of my desk. I have two of them, $39.99 on Amazon, but I had two of those bad boys delivered. They just clip right onto the end of your desk and it'll fit up to a 32-inch computer screen monitor on it. And I have freed up so much space in that, and I actually purchased brand new 32-inch monitors, which were above $100, but just being able to put those big schedules and that up there and see them, it's just been wonderful with making room on my desk.
So it literally has moved your monitor off the desk to the edge of the desk to where you now have another 6 inches, maybe 12 inches of real estate to use for documents.
Yes.
That's nice. If you had to do something else, if someone says you can no longer be a CPA or a CFE, you're done, you get fired today, although I do know you own your own business, what would you be doing?
Oh, and you're going to like this one. I would pack up and move to the Caribbean, and I would be a full-time scuba diving instructor or own the dive shop because I am a certified scuba diving instructor, and I love diving.
Really? What's your favorite place to dive?
My favorite place is in Grenada, which is about 90 miles north of Venezuela. It's an island that's 22 miles long.
I also have, I'm not a certified instructor, but I do have my certification for scuba diving. And
awesome.
Many years ago, I took a trip to Indonesia to teach. And while I was out there, I went to Bali. And there is something called the USS, I believe it's Liberty, USS Liberty, that is a sunken ship about 100 yards out from the shoreline. And you can literally go, it's like 30, 40 feet, 50 feet down. And you can literally see the whole ship. It was sunk during World War II, I believe. Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's one of the best, I think it's supposed to be the best diving site in all of Bali is the USS Liberty when it comes to sinking
Bali's
ships.
Bali's on my bucket list. Bali's definitely on one of the ones on my bucket list of places to get to dive.
It was absolutely amazing, and I saw my first clownfish underneath the water, so that was pretty cool. Yeah, Little Nemo. It was interesting. Little Nemo. He was out there. I saw him. So that was pretty cool.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
Well, Chrissy, thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate you being on the podcast. And good luck to you and your friends accounting firm. And best wishes to you.
All right. Thanks so much, Robert, for having me. I really enjoyed it. This was fun.